The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. Before beginning our program, we would like to invite you to sign up for a free trial subscription to one of our publications at irei.com. Whether you are interested in real estate, infrastructure, or real assets in general, IREI has a publication to suit your needs. Select Publications on the main menu to choose a publication. Interested in more than one? Sign up for them all.
I'm Mike Consul.
And I'm Loretta Klotzalter.
Welcome to Inside the Edition for November 2019. One of your features in the November edition is called Putting It Together, Dry Powder Fuels Interest in Entity Level Investing. I've never even heard of entity level investing. How does that differ from other types of real estate investment?
Entity-level investing is kind of the catch-all term that gets used a lot, but the actual types of investment are things that I think you'd be familiar with. But the basic idea is that instead of investing in a building, you are investing in a real estate company. I think that's really sort of your main distinction. So you're investing in an entity as opposed to a property, a corporate entity. What you'll see happening is both investments in sort of large REITs, maybe taking them private. That would be considered an entity-level investment because you're buying the whole corporate structure and taking it private. And by buying the corporate structure, you are now getting access to all of the real estate owned by that corporate structure. But then you'll also see a thing where you might see just an investment, maybe not an entire acquisition of a company, but just an investment in that company to support its growth and functioning. And you'll see that with a lot of sort of smaller, more local real estate operators will get these investments from either investment managers or institutional investors themselves. Some of the really big institutional investors, the pension funds that we can all think of and remember their names, CalSTRS, the California State Teachers Retirement System, for example, it recently acquired a majority interest in Fairfield Residential. And so that's what you would think of as an entity-level investment. So, and some of these other pension funds, what they will do will be to you make an investment in a local operator, a private company. And by doing so, you're basically sort of not just buying the buildings, but taking advantage of the expertise of all of the people who work there. And so it's kind of a way to sort of staff out your real estate portfolio by making these investments. Sometimes they'll be exclusive relationships, and then the operator might exclusively invest on behalf of that pension fund. And sometimes, it is not an exclusive relationship, but just one of many relationships that an operator might have with different investments.
So there's a lot of different types of real estate investing. Why would I be interested in entity level investing? What does that do for me?
Right. Well, as I was saying, one of the differences, the difference between buying a building and investing in the company that owns that building is accessing the management expertise of those people. So a big advantage of it is personnel. Getting advantage to, getting that access to certain people who are, if you think that somebody's running a building and doing a really good job with a whole portfolio, instead of buying that portfolio and making it your problem, if you invest in the structure, the entity that owns those buildings, you now have access to all of that real estate, which is great, but also access to that management team. So I think that's one of the things that drives that interest. We did a survey, actually, institutional real estate, back in the spring. We did a survey of investors looking at their relationship with REOCs, with real estate operating companies, and the different ways that they would like to invest in them. This was our IREOC Investor Manager Survey on JV partnership investing with REOCs. We did the survey jointly with Kingsley Associates, which we work with them for our annual investor survey as well, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, and hopefully our listeners are as well. But But so we asked investors and investment managers, you know, what types of direct joint venture partnerships are you interested in? And nearly 40% of them said that they would be interested in entity level in joint investments as a joint venture partnership structure. Now, you know, specified asset, the deal, you know, a JV just on a single deal was more popular at, you know, 3/4 of people, but still 40% shows a lot of interest in it. And when you talk about, you know, indirect joint ventures, so talking just to investors about, you know, what sort of investment manager funds that then go on to make joint venture investments, what kind of interest they would have, more than half said they'd be interested in a fund that made entity-level investments. So, you know, I think there is some real interest in entity-level investing among real estate investors, especially the more sophisticated ones who are interested in really kind of getting into what they're doing with their portfolio, as opposed to some of the investors who might only be able to just sort of work in sort of an Odyssey fund structure and really just sort of hand that off to someone else.
So are there any downsides or challenges to entity level investing?
Well, sure. So, I mean, you know, when you're owning the piece of a piece of a company, instead of just a portfolio of assets, it's going to come with its own complexity, and that's one of the real barriers for this, is that it's a much more complex sort of transaction, and it's going to have you know, the just pricing that investment can be a lot more difficult than pricing a building. You've got the whole, because again, it's an entire corporate structure that you're evaluating. You know, other issues might be corporate culture, because again, you're buying or investing in a corporation, so you want to make sure that you have a good culture fit, that the people you're going to be working with are people that you want to work with, and again, that kind of comes back to what I was saying. You know, one of the real advantages is about accessing a particular management team. So again, you want to make sure that these are people you want to have access to.
Right. Yeah, it could be complicated.
You know, and evaluating that team is really one of the real things. You know, that can be a real make or break issue right there. The other thing that's happening is that it has seen a little bit more capital moving into this space. Some of that might be driven just by other trends in the real estate industry, high valuations, investors looking for alternatives, other ways to get into real estate. But what that is meaning is that with a little bit more capital coming into the entity level investment space, people, you know, other people looking to make investments in these real estate operating companies, it's maybe getting a little more expensive. It's maybe getting a little bit more crowded, and that's another thing to keep an eye on.
Hmm. So issue number two, rent control, which has been in the news a lot lately, and I know that in the November edition you have a story about rent control and the challenges it poses as a public policy. Most economists don't believe rent control, they believe rent control has a negative effect on the residential market. What's the rationale? What is that negative effect? How does it deploy itself? Why are economists, most economists anyway, saying this is not good for the residential market?
Right. Yeah, we have an article looking at rent control. As you mentioned, it's been in the news a lot. California, for instance, has been working on some rent control efforts, as has the state of Oregon. You know, you'll see it a lot at maybe at the sort of the local or the city, the municipal level. But so these are bigger statewide efforts looking at different types of rent control efforts. The reason, you know, so economists are just very skeptical. They're almost unanimous in thinking that, in particular, a rent ceiling is just a very bad idea for an apartment market. The thinking is that with rent control, you have an inhibition of apartment construction, of new construction, as well as a reduction in value of the rent-controlled units. And so you're going to see what that leads to is just that's going to have a decline in property tax revenues, which is going to make it harder for governments to support, you know, different services. You know, it's going to create excess demand because if you don't have enough buildings being built, then you have more people who want an apartment unit than is available. So you have this situation of high demand, but sort of, you know, limits on who gets those things. It can, you know, it creates winners and losers, but not always the ones that you would want. And I think that's why there are other ways to provide affordable housing to people that go beyond the imposition of rent controls.
I tend to think of rent control as something that's done in big cities, but I believe Oregon, you mentioned Oregon, I believe they did that statewide, is that correct? They just said across the state we're going to put some controls on rent?
Right, that's my understanding. Oregon has gone statewide, and California is also looking at doing the same. For instance, state legislators in September in California, they passed a law that limits annual rent increases to 5% plus the rate of inflation. Now, so that's a little bit different than a rent ceiling. It's just sort of, it's a limit on how much rent can be raised from year to year, you know, so at a lease renewal. But it does still kind of keep a lid on the overall ability for landlords to raise rents, which, I mean, the sad or true truth is that if a developer is not going to be able to make enough rent to cover the construction of a building, they will not build that building. You know, you have to be able to cover the costs and have enough rent to cover that. And so, you know, if you have a limited ability to you know, make rent or to grow your NOI, you're just not going to see the same level of development. And I think the reason this is really coming to a head again, and we've talked about this, there is an affordable housing crisis across the country, especially on the West Coast. This is why, you know, you're seeing California, Oregon looking at these measures. And it really is driven by a housing shortage. That is what's underlying the problem here. That the housing shortage that you're seeing, it drives up costs. It, you know, demand becomes higher than supply. You get these imbalances, and with that, you know, you then it's like, well, how do we fix this? How do we make housing more affordable? And rent control, it is, in the short term, does do that. And that's why a lot of people, you know, kind of turn to that as like the best answer. But it really can distorts the market, and it can, you know, it just has some negative effects.
The last statistic I heard, more than 60% of U.S. residents are paying more than they should be paying based on their income, that they're basically living in unaffordable housing. And there's a lot of stated solutions, but it never seems like we really get on top of this stuff. Let's also switch to your editorial, because you've been fairly obsessed with WeWork, I would say.
I'm not the only one. In my defense, I am not the only one.
No, the whole media
has
been obsessed. So get us up to date.
I can't help myself.
I think, and I'm speaking for myself, but I think a lot of other people, in addition to me, kind of saw that implosion and then kind of stopped paying attention. But what happened with WeWork? Kind of summarize for us what happened again, where they are now, what it means for office landlords more broadly.
Well, and I think it's that last piece that's going to be the really important part. You know, WeWork is just one company, but this whole move has some implications. So, you know, to catch you up, a year ago-ish, WeWork was flying high. They had gotten, you know, their latest funding round, largely backed by, you know, they got a lot of money from SoftBank, based out of Japan, and SoftBank's $100 billion Vision Fund, which is itself, you know, had raised capital from around the world, including a lot of investors from the Middle East. This huge venture capital fund. gigantic. It also invested in Uber, which also is looking a little bit questionable post-IPO. But so what the Vision Fund did is it went out and it would make these big investments in, you know, sort of late-stage private tech companies. And WeWork was considered a tech company for, well, reasons that have more to do with just the market than their actual business. And I think that's really the issue here. But so, $47 billion valuation. They decide it's time to do their IPO. They're going to go public over the summer. You know, they get all, they're getting ready. And what is astonishing is that they file for their IPO, and their S-1 filing is the kind of document that typically, you know, I don't know if you've read a lot of S-1 filing documents, Mike.
I have not.
But they're a little dry. it's a little dry. It's, you know, these are just sort of very, you know, kind of very bland, very legalese, very like sort of laying out what you're going to do. WeWork treated it like a promotional story, and it, well, when they laid out their business, the public market just recoiled, just pulled back. You know, it was just, they were not interested in WeWork. You know, and so valuation, you know, is no longer looking at $47 billion. You know, they kind of, you know, the bankers start saying, well, would the market be interested at, I don't know, $20 billion, let's say. They could not, they just did not see any interest. It seemed like everyone had just sort of, basically, they had, you know, cancel culture came to WeWork, and WeWork got canceled. And, you know, so they shelved the IPO. But, and this is the thing about the WeWork business, they need cash. That's why they're going public in the first place. They need money to run this business because it has been losing money year after year after year, growing bigger and bigger and bigger and losing money the whole time. So the where we're at right now, SoftBank has bailed WeWork out. They have pushed out the CEO, Adam Neumann. They've added an infusion of cash. They've taken a larger stake in the company. The new valuation is under $8 billion. It's, you know, that's all pretty ugly for the Vision Fund, the venture capital community. You know, a lot of that is everyone's got a little bit of egg on their face, and, you know, SoftBank is writing down its investments by billions of dollars. That's bad. But that's on the VC side. Let's talk about the real estate side. WeWork is the biggest private landlord in New York City. You know, what happens to office landlords if WeWork doesn't just struggle to get funding, can't make an IPO, but actually goes out of business, which was unthinkable a year ago and is no longer unthinkable at this point? And that's, I think, the really crucial issue of, you know, what it means for office landlords broadly is, you know, I think, and this is actually true, I was at one of our editorial advisory board meetings just a couple weeks ago in Asia, in Hong Kong, for our Asia Pacific magazine, and one of the two hot topics, like the big topics at that meeting, in addition to what was happening in Hong Kong, which is, you know, where we were meeting, was WeWork. Like, everyone wanted to talk about it, and, you know, the big question really was, how many leases do you have with WeWork? What's your exposure to them? What would happen if they pulled out? You know, and the consensus was really, right now, it still looks like a good tenant, looks like a good business, but you do not want them to have more than, say, 10 to 20% of the space in a building. Because, you know, you definitely want to limit your risk there. And there is definitely risk there. And I guess, you know, in some of their later leases and some buildings, especially outside the U.S., they've taken, you know, 90% of a building. I just want to say, if you've got a building with 90% leased to WeWork right now, you're nervous.
Especially when they do these fast.
You're really, really concerned about how this is going. You know, 10% allocation to WeWork. I was actually told there a 10% allocation to WeWork has actually been great for a lot of landlords. They've been very happy with WeWork as a tenant. This is, you know, this is the weird thing about the whole WeWork phenomenon is that the real estate side, you know, it seems to. I mean, they do keep making. You know, they are having trouble making money, but it's unclear how much of that is just driven by their insatiable growth, and how much of it is driven by kind of bad leasing bets. You know, it does actually seem like a big, like if the company decided to become a real estate firm and not some high flying tech company, they might make a go of it. You know, they could be a Regis, but they didn't want to be Regis.
A company that's been around, a company that's been around a long time. Regis.
Yeah, and you know, Regis. I think they're owned by the IHG Group, I think now. You know, they're valued at 4x earnings. It's a solid, stable business. Nothing fancy. Nothing high flying. They don't have the, you know, 40x earnings or whatever that you're seeing in these WeWork valuations. You know, but can WeWork do that? You know, the stories now, and of course, you know how the media loves to build someone up and then tear them down.
It's exciting.
You know, the corporate culture at WeWork sounds much more like that of a tech company than sort of a stable institutional real estate player. I think that's how I'll leave it.
Well, and they wanted a tech valuation. It is the latest. This is broader than the purposes of our discussion, but just kind of in wrapping up, it's yet another one of those situations where a company says, let's go public. They do not get treated well by the public market. They get beat back. And we have far fewer public companies today than we did years ago. And the cost of going public, all the regulations and whatnot, it's just yet another lesson that you have to really think hard about whether it's beneficial to go public, and if you're going to go public, to be very circumspect about your valuation, because other people are going to be if you're not.
I agree. You know, I do think broadly this does sort of raise some questions about just with the value of public versus private entities. And, you know, we do, especially in the real estate space, you do see a lot of advantages, you know, toward the private side. Private equity real estate definitely has its ups and downs. It has its challenges and advantages. But I do think that's something you see in the real estate space, which again goes through cycles of moving towards the public markets and then pulling back.
Well, when it comes to WeWork, we know that you're based on your obsession. You'll be keeping us posted in the months to come.
I will. I am not the only one obsessed. I will say that much. But yes, I will keep you updated.